The content in this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Well, last week we were talking about planting and growth and things. Let's continue on that theme with the nature section of the Reader's Digest, Growing Joy. Gardening yields endless rewards, the first sprouts to final harvest, and the best part, sharing that bounty. That's unless it's one of those long, thin things that they pass that everybody wants to get rid of. It's that time of year again. I'm sitting in front of the fire looking through a small stack of seed catalogs. From High Mowing Organic Seeds, Seed Savers Exchange. The main potato lady. Today, though, I am loving the Fedco catalog because it is printed on newsprint, with the veggies and fruit depicted not in photographs but with beautiful and sometimes goofy drawings. One is an excellent rendering of someone drawing back a bow and arrow, except the arrow is a pod of peas. In another, some pumpkin-shaped people are admiring a pumpkin. A couple of leaves of the dinosaur kale are cute. Happy baby dinosaurs, that kind of thing. There's no greater sucker for seeds than me. When I flip through these pages of photos and drawings and my descriptions, I start dreaming. Oh, my Shago Callaloo. Look how big these leaves are. Wait, hold up. Back peanuts? I wonder how they do in Indiana. Oh, orange watermelons. Goes on and on, for the enticements are legion, and often irresistible. It makes me think the seed catalog, through an expression of consumer culture, must be among the very most beneficent. And then I start filling up my cart. Two of this, three of that, 5 pounds of elephant garlic. Were three more than do? 4 packs of butter beans. Oh, they have those Italian red sim dandelions. 5 of those. If it were almost anything else, I would say to myself, as my mother occasionally did when I was a kid, and it heaped up a mountain of fried potatoes and spaghetti on my plate. Rossi, I think your eyes might be bigger than your stomach. By which arm our city loss is approximately 1/10 of an acre, and I just brought enough seeds. Hang on, they have shallots. Going to get a couple of pounds of those to plant an acre, or maybe even 2 or 3. When the packages start arriving in the mail and keep arriving, Stephanie, my partner, and I start giggling. And then sometimes they put our hands over our faces and groan, oh no. But the fact of the matter is, whether or not I am thinking in the moment as I click the arrow button, up, 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 4, 5, 6, we'll give away a lot of these seeds. We'll give them to friends or neighbors, whoever could use them. Not because we're saints, but because we're gardeners. And if you garden, that's kind of just what you do. For example, if we were to take a very quick tour of this garden in a few months, I could point out to you just how many plants have been given to us. Over in the herb bed, growing with the lemon balm and chamomile, are the Egyptian onions Amy gave us. Bryce gave us the black raspberries under the crabapple tree. Oh, I love black raspberries. The figs came from my friend Jay's father, Mr. Lowell. Jessica gave us the daffodils. My friend Ada sent some sweetgrass, the roots diapered in moist paper towels, which now grows out front next to the comfrey Jamie gave us. The stand-up peonies next to them were dropped off over a decade ago, as a housewarming gift by someone whose name I have forgotten. Wait, Andy. His name was Andy. And those flowers make one of my favorite smells on this earth, as does the star magnolia that Crystal gave us, and the lily given by my mother, which she even helped me plant. Among gardeners, there is a near constant chatter, asking what you need, asking what you have any, asking if you use this. One day Roro texts, hey, do you have a few heads of garlic? The next day she calls herself in a big stand of serviceberry bushes she wants to show me. One day Bunny asks, can I get a few of those sweet potatoes? The next he says, I got a haul of chicken in the woods. Let me bring it by. Amy tells us we should harvest some of their persimmons, and I bring some of those pumpkin purple hot peppers that are coming in like crazy. Or, perhaps this is the cream of the cream, when our friend Katie gives me a packet of seeds she saved from tomatoes we'd given her that were given to us seedlings by our friend Mark. Back and forth and back and forth and back and forth it goes. Why is this back and forth a gardener's disposition, or more the point, practice? It's a garden, a healthy, thriving garden, tells us to. Whether we know it or not, we're just emulating the garden, which is a repository of sharing. During the COVID-19 lockdown, wandering around out back and looking for more places to plant, I noticed there was a strip between the raised beds in the alley, maybe 3 or 4 feet wide. I borrowed our neighbor's pickup and dug a 6-inch trench in the gravel down to the soil. which seemed weirdly wormy for being beneath gravel. Then I filled that trench with planting mix as I scrounged from the garage before planting a bunch of sunflowers with seeds that we had in our stash. The seeds were 4 or 5 years old, and I was planting them into a gravel trench. And although planting seeds is always an act of faith, this qualified as maybe a little extra. About a week later, when I was weeding the trench on my knees, I almost accidentally pulled a sunflower spout, pushing its pale neck from the soil. But after seeing that one, I then recognized a couple of others in the same set of unfurl. And within a few days, almost all the seeds I'd planted had sprouted. And they were like a tiny, unevenly staged, staggered green colonnade, and there's a picture of a couple of them. In just a few months, lining our alley was a gorgeous family of mismatched sunflowers, several of them taller than I am. I would not infrequently go out and chat with them, by which I mean I pour a little water into the trench beneath their feet, and run my hand over their delicate faces, features that were also popular about a zillion pollinating critters, that were also possible with about a zillion pollinating critters. By the time the temperature started dropping into the low 60s in the early fall, I noticed on my morning moseys with coffee in hand, gardens are for moseys, please note that, teeny bumble-looking bees nestled in the sunflowers. This course you can tell the flowers being pollinated by these guys. They're impossibly beautiful swirl of seeds fiddling out nuzzle by nuzzle, and the time is chilly enough for the bees sleep their nights elsewhere. Their work has been done and done well, to which the goldfinches testify. As far as I'm concerned, you will never find a lovelier bird. And these ones, they are like baseball players this way, are crazy for sunflower seeds. They perch on the big greening face and dig in, stammering their beaks with such passion you will sometimes see shell shards flying and hear what sounds like an Elvin Jones album jazz drum solo. And wouldn't you know, these goldfinches in their glee very kindly plant for us several sunflowers, a few just where you want them, and a few we dig up young and replant elsewhere. I put in the seeds. The rain and sun brought them up. The pollinators caroused the flowers into seeds. The birds gobbled the seeds into more plants, and on and on and on. If we pay just a little of attention in gardening, we notice that it's constant, this sharing. And if we drop beneath the surface where so much of garden work happens with the roots and beetles and worms all busy with their dark labors, we see mycelium webbing through that dark, knitting it all together, redistributing nutrients, sharing the wealth, back and forth and back and forth. All of which is why I bristle at the idea of gardening as an act of self-sufficiency or independence. I get the premise. Growing what you can't buy is awesome. Knowing where your food comes from is lovely. Sticking it to big grocery is fun, etc. But a garden, a healthy garden anyway, so it says no matter how hard you try, no matter how much you earn or stash or hoard or bunker up, you will never be self-sufficient or independent. Because nothing living is. Neither bacteria nor bald eagle, nor billionaire, nor you, nor me. In addition to the fact that we all die, the most salient and undefined feature of the living is that we cannot survive without help. Even the most prepped and rugged survivalist, though in his mind prepared to go it free of human help, will not make it very far without fish and deer batteries, wild greens, and firewood. It means you are the beneficiary of a largesse so large, so deep, you will never in one lifetime get to the bottom of it. But instead, by celebrating that kindness, which we do in part by sharing what that kindness has given us, we might harvest what is planted on that kindness. Just the other day, my mother told me her mother always grew a hearty pinto bean they called Dutch bean, in one her grandmother had always grown. Though my mother made a face that I'm pretty sure meant she didn't love it, my granny obviously did, and it fed my mother all the same. I suspect my great-grandmother, Biggie, whom she fled from Port Gibson, Mississippi from Youngstown, Ohio, in 1913, brought with her some seeds from which to create the garden she fed everyone from. We are all made of these stories, even if we don't know them. People saved these seeds because they loved these seeds, and they thought we might love them too. Whoever saved seeds loved us before they knew us. Our garden's archives follow that love. Except from the book Inciting Joy. Yes, it's by Ross Gray. National interest. And there's a picture of a younger black lady and an older one in a, sitting in a wheelchair, and the younger one is pouring tea and iced tea and was obviously a coffee cup. Fairland Lewis pours a cup of tea for a mother who needs a wheelchair after suffering a stroke. I had to do it. Americans are living longer, forcing loved ones to make impossible choices about their long-term care. Margaret Newcomb, 69, a retired French teacher, is desperately trying to protect her retirement services by caring for her 82-year-old husband, who has had severe dementia at home in Seattle. She used to fear his disease-induced paranoia, but now he's so frail and confused that he wanders away with no idea how to find his way home. He gets lost so often that she attaches a tag with her phone number to his shoelace. Phelan Lewis, 36, sacrificed a promising career as a research director in England to return home to Nashville in 2021 after her mother had a debilitating stroke. They ran up $15,000 in medical and credit card debt while Lewis took on the role of caretaker. Millions of families are facing such daunting life choices and potential financial ruin. As the escalating cost of in-home care, assisted living facilities, and nursing homes devour the savings and incomes of older Americans and their relatives, people are exposed to the possibility of depleting almost all their wealth, says Richard W. Johnson, director of the Program on Retirement Policy at Urban Institute, a nonprofit think tank. The prospect of dying broke looms as an imminent threat for a baby boomer generation, which vastly expanded the middle class and looked hopefully toward a comfortable retirement on the back tone of pensions and 401ks. Roughly 10,000 boomers will turn 65 every day until 2030. Many expected to live in their 80s to 90s as the price tag for long-term care explodes, outpacing inflation and reaching nearly $500 billion a year, according to federal researchers. The challenges will only grow. By 2050, the population of America ages 65 and older is projected to increase by more than 50% to 86 million, according to Censor estimates. The number of people 85 or older will nearly triple to 19 million. The United States has no coherent system of long-term care. It's mostly a patchwork. The private market, where the minuscule portions of families buy long-term care insurance, has shriveled, reduced over the year of giant rate hikes by insurers that had underestimated how much care people would actually use. Labor shortages that left families searching for workers willing to care for their elders in their homes. And the cost of a spot in an assigned living facility has soared to an unaffordable level for most middle-class Americans. They have to run out of money to qualify for nursing home care afforded by the government. But 8 million people ages 65 and over reported that they had dementia or difficulty with basic daily taxes like bathing and feeding themselves, and nearly 3 million of them had no assistance at all, according to a federally funded study, which surveyed elderly people with their long-term care needs and financial resources. Most people relied on spouses, children, grandchildren, or friends. The United States devotes smaller share of its gross domestic product to long-term care than do most other wealthy countries, including Britain, France, Canada, Germany, Sweden, and Japan, according to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. The United States lags behind its international peers in another way. It dedicates far less of its overall health spending towards long-term care. We just don't value elders the way that other countries and other cultures do, says Rachel Werner, executive director of the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics at the University of Pennsylvania. We don't have a financing and insurance system for long-term care, she says. This isn't the political will to spend that much money. Despite medical advances that have added years to the average lifespan and allowed people to survive decades more after getting cancer or suffering from heart disease or strokes, federal long-term care for older people has not fundamentally changed in decades since President Lyndon Johnson signed the Medicare and Medicaid into law in 1965. From 1960 to 2021, the number of Americans 85 and older increased at more than six times the rate of the general population, according to the census records. Medicare, the federal health insurance program for marriages ages 65 and older, covers the cost of medical care but generally pays for a home aide or stay in a nursing home only for a limited time during recovery from a surgery or a fall, or for short-term rehabilitation. Medicaid, the federal state program, covers long-term care, usually in a nursing home, but only for the poor. Middle-class people must exhaust their assets to qualify, forcing them to sell much of their property and empty their bank accounts. If they go into a nursing home, they are permitted to keep a pittance of their retirement income, $600 or less a month in most states. And spouses can hold on to only modest amount of income and assets, often needing their children and grandchildren to shoulder some of the financial burden. You basically want people to destitute themselves, and then you take everything else that they have, says Gay Gillen, whose mother lived in a nursing home in Kansas until she died last October at age 96. Her mother, Betty Gay Glenn, had to spend down her savings, paying the home more than $10,000 a month until she qualified for Medicaid. Gay, 61, relocated from Chicago to Topeka for more than 4 years ago, moving into one of her mother's two rental properties and overseeing her care and finances. Under the state's Medicaid program, Byzantine Rules, she had to pay rent to her mother, and that income went towards her mother's care. Gay sold the family's house just before her mother's death. Her lawyer told the estate had to pay Medicaid back about $20,000 from the proceeds. At any given time, skilled nursing homes house roughly 630,000 older residents, whose average age is about 77, according to recent estimates. A long-term resident's care can easily cost more than $100,000 a year without Medicaid coverage at these institutions, which are supposed to provide round-the-clock nursing coverage. According to a public opinion poll by KFF, formerly the Kaiser Family Foundation, 9 out of 10 people said it would be impossible or very difficult to pay that much. Efforts to create a long-term care system have repeatedly collapsed. Democrats have argued the federal government needs to take a much stronger hand in subsidizing care in the Medicaid program. Demand has clearly outstripped supply, according to a recent analysis. While the number of home aides in the Medicaid program has increased to 1.4 million in 2019, from 840,000 in 2008, the number of aides per 100 people who qualify for home or community care has declined nearly 12%. The labor shortages are largely attributed to low wages for difficult work. The Biden administration sought to improve wages and working conditions for paid caregivers, but $150 billion proposal in the 2021 Build Back Better Act for in-home community-based services under Medicaid was dropped to lower the bill's price tag. This is an issue coming to the front door of members of Congress, says Senator Bob Casey, Democrat of Pennsylvania and chair of the Senate Special Committee on Aging. No matter where you're representing, if you're representing a blue state or a red state, families are not going to settle for just having one option, he says, referring to nursing homes funded under Medicaid. The federal government has got to do its part, which it hasn't. But leading Republicans in Congress say the federal government cannot be expected to step in more than it already does. Americans need to save for when they inevitably need care, says Senator Mike Braun of Indiana, the ranking Republican on the Aging Committee. So often people just think it's just going to work out, he says. Too many people get to the point where they're 65 and then say, I don't have that much there. Boomers are jogging and cycling into retirement, equipped with hip and knee replacements that have slowed their aging, and they are loath to enter the institutional setting of a nursing home. But they face major expenses. For the in-between years, when many fall along a spectrum between good health and needing round-the-clock care in a nursing home, that has led to many assisted living centers run by for-profit companies and private equity funds, which are enjoying robust profits in this growing market. Some 850,000 people aged 65 and older now live in these facilities, which are largely ineligible for federal funds and run the gamut, with some providing only basics such as help getting dressed and taking medication, and others offering luxury amenities such as day trips, gourmet meals, yoga, and spas. The bills can be staggering. Half of the nation's assisted living facilities cost at least $54,000 a year, according to Genworth, a long-term care insurance that rises substantially in many metropolitan areas with lofty real estate prices. Specialized settings like locked memory care units for those with dementia can cost twice as much. Home care is costly, too. Agencies charge about $27 an hour for home health aid. Hiring someone who spends 6 or 7 hours a day cleaning and helping an older person can get out of bed, can take medications, and up to $60,000 a year. As Americans live longer, the number who develop dementia has soared, as have their needs. An estimated 5 million to 7 million Americans over age 65 had dementia, and their ranks are projected to grow steadily, nearly 12 million by 2040. The condition robs people of their memories, mars their ability to speak and understand, and can alter their personality substantially. In Seattle, Margaret and Tim Newcomb sleep on separate floors of their two-story cottage, with Margaret ever mindful of their husband, who has dementia, can hallucinate and become aggressive if medication fails to tame his symptoms. The anger has diminished from the early days, she says, but earlier on she resorted to calling the police when he acted erratically. He was hating me and angry, but I didn't feel safe, she says. She considers the memory care units, but the least expensive option costs $8,000 a month. The price for some facilities could reach nearly twice that amount. The couple's monthly income with his pension from the Seattle City Light, a utility company, and their combined Social Security is $6,000. Placing her husband in such a facility would have gutted the $500,000 they had saved before she retired from 35 years of teaching art and French at a parochial school. I'll let go of everything I have if I have to, but it's a very unfair system, she says. If you didn't see ahead or didn't have the right type of job that provides for you, it's tough luck. In the last year, medication has quelled Tim's anger, and his health has also declined so much that he no longer poses a physical threat. Margaret says she's reconciled to caring for him as long as she can. When I see him sitting out on the porch and appreciating the sun coming on his face, it's really sweet, she says. As Americans live longer, the number who develop dementia has soared, as have their needs. An estimated 5 to 7 million Americans over age 65 have dementia, and their ranks are projected to grow to near 12 million by 2040. The condition robs people of their memories, bars the ability to speak and understand, and can alter their personalities. In Seattle, well, there it is. I'm sorry, I missed something there. The financial threat posed by dementia also weighs heavily on adult children who have become guardians of aged parents and have watched their slow, expensive declines. Claudia Morell, 65, of Parkville, Maryland, estimated that her mother, Regina Hayes, spent more than $1 million during the 8 years she needed residential care for dementia. That was possibly only because her mother had two pensions, one from her husband's military service and another from his job in an insurance company, plus savings and Social Security. As her mother's guardian, Morrow paid the required legal fees as well as $6,000 on a special bed so her mother wouldn't fall out, and more on private aids after she suffered repeated small strokes. Her mother died last December at age 87. As awful as it may sound, her mother was lucky. I will never have those kinds of resources, says Morrell, an education consultant. My children will never have those kind of resources. We didn't inherit enough or aren't going to earn enough to have the quality of care she got. You certainly can't live that way on Social Security. For 7 years, Annie Reed abandoned her life in Colorado to sleep in her childhood bedroom in Maryland, living out of her suitcase and caring for her mother, Frances Ambogna, who had dementia. No one else in my family was able to do this, she says. It just dawned on me. I have to actually unpack and live here. Reed, 62, remembers thinking, and how long? There's no timeline on it. After Ambogna died at the end of September 2022, her daughter returned to Colorado and started a furniture redesign business, a craft she had taught herself in his mother's basement. Reed recently had her knee replaced, something she could not do in Maryland because her insurance didn't cover doctors there. Studies are now calculating the toll of caregiving on children, especially women. The median lost wages for women providing intensive care for their mothers is $24,500 over 2 years, according to a study led by Norman Coe, an associate professor at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Finlan Lewis had to move back from England to Nashville to care for her mother, a former nurse who had a stroke that put her in a wheelchair. She is also tending to her elderly grandfather, who is ill with prostate cancer and kidney disease. I was thrust back into a caregiving role full-time, Lewis says. She gave up a post as a research director for a nonprofit organization. Making up for lost income seems daunting while she continues to support her mother, but she is regaining hope. She was promoted to assistant dean for student affairs at Vanderbilt School of Nursing and was recently married. She and her husband plan to stay in the same apartment with her mother until they can save enough to move into a larger place. The only true safety net for many Americans is Medicaid, which represent by far the largest single source of funding for long-term care. More than 4 or 5 middle-class people over 65 who need long-term care for 5 years or more will eventually enroll, according to the Urban Institute. Almost half of upper-middle-class people with average lifetime earnings of more than $118,830 per year will also end up on Medicaid if they receive paid long-term care for at least 5 years. But gaps in Medicaid coverage leave many people without care. Under federal law, the program is obliged to offer nursing home care in every state. In-home care, which is not guaranteed, is provided under state waivers, and the number of participants is limited. Many states have long awaiting lists, and they can be extremely difficult to find aides willing to work in the low-paying Medicare rate. Qualifying for a slot in a nursing home paid by Medicaid can be formidable. with many families spending thousands of dollars on lawyers and consultants to navigate state rules. Homes may be sold or couples may contemplate divorce to become eligible. And recipients and their spouse may still have to contribute significant sums. After Stan Markowitz, a former history professor in Baltimore with Parkinson's disease, and his wife, Dottie Burt, 78, exhausted their savings on his two-year stay in an assisted living facility, he qualified for Medicaid and moved into a nursing home. He was required to contribute $2,700 a month, which ate up 45% of the couple's retirement income. Burt, who was a Rachel Justice consultant for nonprofits, rented a modest apartment near the home, all she could afford on what was left of their income. Markowitz died in September at age 86, easing the financial pressure on her. "I won't be having to pay the nursing home," she says. Even finding a place willing to take someone can be a struggle. Sheila Littleton's grandfather, Harold Murray, could no longer live safely in rural North Carolina because his worsening dementia led him to wander. She brought him to Houston in November 2020, then spent months trying to enroll him in the state's Medicaid program so he could be in a locked unit in a nursing home. She felt she was getting the runaround. Nursing home after nursing home told her there were no beds, or quibbled over when and how he would be eligible for a bed under Medicaid. In desperation, she left him at a psychiatric hospital so it would find him a spot. "I had to refuse to take him back home," she says. "They had no choice but to place him. That was terrible. I had to do it." He was finally approved for coverage in early 2022 at age 83. A few months later, he died. Your true stories. Good campers leave no trace. Bad ones leave with hilarious stories. Don't poke the bears. A black bear approached our camp hide in Shenandoah National Park, so we slowly walked away. Meanwhile, a man from the next campsite walked toward the bear, clapping his hands and yelling, "Go, bear, go!" Magically, the bear went back into the woods. When it returned hours later, I stood my ground, loudly clapped, and yelled, "Go, bear!" It didn't work right away as it had for our camping neighbor, but the bear did leave after several rounds. As it lumbered away, I heard someone roaring toward us. It was the man from earlier. "I forgot to tell you," he panted. "You say, go, bear, go, and he doesn't go. You need to go." Overheard the herd. My best friend and I took advantage of an unseasonably warm weekend to camp in Rocky Mountain National Park. The campsite was deserted. We had forgotten it would still be freezing at high elevation, but decided to camp anyway. All night, the wind created strange noises. In the morning, we unzipped the tent and discovered the noises weren't wind, and the campsite wasn't deserted. We were smack in the middle of a herd of elk. They'd moved in during the night and were as confused to see us as we were to see them. The call of the child. During a family camping trip, my mom called everyone back to our site for dinner. All of us kids appeared except for my three-year-old sister, Wendy. After a thorough search, we found her sitting at attention, hands folded, at another family's picnic table. Their Wendy Gay Brown, also 3-year-old, was sitting next to our Wendy Gay Browning. Apparently, they both immediately responded to the first, "Wendy Gay, come sit down and eat." Last ditch, first pitch. Early in our relationship, my now husband and I went camping together. Neither of us had much experience. It took forever to pitch the tent, but we eventually did it and were quite pleased with ourselves. But within minutes, a park ranger informed us we set up in the RV area. Taking pity, he helped us load our tent into the bed of his truck without taking it down, and drove us to the tents-only area. Eating for two. My husband and I thought a Rocky Mountain backpacking trip would be romantic. A weekend I got quite sick. Even the scent of food was nauseating. I powered through and went to the doctor as soon as we got home. That evening I set up a candlelight dinner, and as we sat down I reminded my husband about the doctor's visit. Surprise and excitement and understanding flashed across his face, and I told him something was growing in my stomach. Until I elaborated, I had a parasite. In need of some support. My friend offered to bring his new tent on our Yosemite Cali camps trip. We got to the campsite and rolled out his beautiful tent. I asked where the poles were. He finally inquired, "Well, they're on the second shelf in the garage." Well, we slept under the stars that weekend. When life tries to give you lemonade. As a teenager, Bob worked at a Boy Scout camp in the New Mexico mountains. When campers left every weekend, the staff rushed to do our laundry. We all used citrus-scented powder we found next to the washing machine. At the end of the season, somebody took a loss and realized we'd been washing our clothes in lemonade drink mix all summer. Cowered away. I'm from Colorado and grew up camping, so I'm tough to rattle. But once, while camping with my husband, firebirding, tent pitch, night falling, We heard this repetitive guttural noise. Whatever it was making the noise was approaching and sounded huge and horrible. We slept in the car, scared out of our wits. In the morning, we discovered the source, a cow trail right on the other side of the bushes. The horrible sounds were just cows coming down from the pasture. The laws of nature. My wife and I managed campground for many years. One summer, a recent group of high school graduates reserved a campsite next to us. That night, I had to issue a few general warnings about quiet hours until they finally settled down. The next morning, I heard over one of the girls say, "Well, we learned one thing last night." "What's that?" another asked. "Never camp next to the camp manager." Hit the hay on the runway. My family arrived at a campground after dark and woke up at the office manager so we could check in. He told us to find a spot and we'd take care of the paperwork in the morning. We found a perfectly clear, level spot, pitched our tent, and fell asleep. We awoke a few hours later to the office manager running to our tent, shouting for us to wake up. Our perfectly level camping spot was a small runway, and a plane was circling overhead waiting to land. My smart pet. Nora, a cat belonging to philosophic music teacher Betsy Alexander, noticed how her owner focused on her students while they were playing piano. So the gray tabby began tickling the ivories when she wanted attention. Do you realize a moment when you realize your dog, cat, fish, bird, bunny, lizard, horse, or any critter was smarter than they let on? See the terms and share your story at rd.com/smartpet. It might appear in an issue of Reader's Digest. And let's switch over to Consumer Reports. And kind of interestingly, we just had a click about older folks and problems with nursing homes and stuff. And here's the thing about getting around more easily, which really hits people like the over 50 group like I am, actually considerably over 50. Whether you're grabbing some groceries or biking across town, we have the tips and tools to take you there. And there's a picture here, a drawing here, of people with a push cart, a backpack, a bicycle, a folding bicycle, walking sticks, a walker, canes, another bicycle, and looks like a skateboard. We want to make it easier to carry home your goodies from the bakery up the hill. Walk to the coffee bar a few blocks away, or wait in line with a package on a busy day at the post office. The right gear can make all of that much more comfortable as well as safer. There's a growing number of well-designed, well-priced tools out there to help. These include personal shopping carts that are easy to maneuver, even when full of groceries, rollators that have sturdy seats that you can take a brief break while on a walk, e-bikes that make going uphill a breeze. Here, from CR's tests and outside experts, is a rundown on what's new and useful to help you get where you want to go, on foot or by bicycle. Walking. Walking poles, cane, shopping cart, rollator. What you pick should fit your body and your needs, says Nancy Gell, Ph.D., a physical therapist at the University of Vermont College of Nursing and Health Sciences. Good news, some of the mobility tools below are covered by insurance. Poles. If you've been on a nature trail in recent years, you've probably seen people striding along with walking poles, a.k.a. knocking or treading poles. These help distribute your body weight more evenly and have long been used by hikers for stability and support on rough terrain. Turns out they may help you safely navigate uneven sidewalks as well. Plus, they can improve your posture by engaging your upper body and encourage you to stand up straight. Choosing right. For walking on sidewalks, look for lightweight aluminum or composite poles with rubber tips. Other tips are for dirt, ice, or snow, says Karen Jacobs, OTEDD, Associate Dean of Digital Learning and Innovation at the Sargent College of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences at Boston University. Some, such as the York Noti Motivator walking poles, are height adjustable. Others, like the Black Diamond Pursuit shock trekking poles, have shock-absorbing internal springs, making a walk easier on your joints. For hand-cuppered, both above have ergonomic hand grips, as do the Urban Poling Activator poles, $119 at Target. The Black Diamond Pursuit shock trekking poles are $170 with a pair. Canes. They come in numerous styles, including the rustic wooden beauties at websites such as BrassosWalkingSticks.com and endlessly customizable ones from NeoWalk.com. Looks aside, a cane's essential purpose is to take some weight off a sore or injured knee or hip, says Christine Childers, Ph.D., Director of Physical Therapy at the University of Arizona College of Medicine in Tucson. They can also steady your balance if you're feeling wobbly. Choosing right. For most people, an offset cane with a curved top that can bear some of your weight can go a long way in making a walk more comfortable. The experts we interviewed says a height-adjustable, lightweight aluminum or carbon fiber cane with non-slip rubber tip such as the Mosaic Stend Window Offset Walking Cane with Comfort Grip from RoyalCanes.com, is generally best for convenience. A folding cane like the 7.X Alexi Super Micro Adjustable Travel Cane, $74 for Elder Deluxe, can be stashed in your bag and pulled out when you need it. The Mosaic Stained Window Offset Walking Cane costs $29.95. Shopping carts. Walking and spot that hard-to-find flavor of your favorite seltzer? A personal shopping cart can make it much easier to tote a case or any other heavy or bucking items back home. But because they're more compact than typical supermarket shopping carts, they're simpler to navigate in crowded store aisles. Choosing right. For optimal maneuverability, look for a cart that has a swiveling front wheels, like those on the VersaCart Transit Utility Cart, $84 from Wayfarer, and the PippiShell Shopping Cart, $70 from Amazon.com. The PippiShell also has height-adjustable handles. A cart with its own removable shopping bag at waist height, such as the Juvie Boot at left, which costs $230, eliminates the need to bend over far or to lift out groceries. If you'll be going up any stairs, consider a tri-wheel design, which has three toting wheels or spokes on the back of the cart, like those in a mounted fabric stair climber, $65 from HomePod. Try those when you're on feet. Bags for extras. With a reusable tote, you'll always be able to load up at the farmer's market. The machine washable Bagu tote bag for $14 fits compactly into its own carrying case, as does a Zizzy crossbody packable travel tote for $25. Hands-free pack. For carrying a few necessities, Karen Jacobs, an occupational therapist at Boston University, recommends a lightweight backpack with a padded shoulder straps and a hip strap. One that may fit the bill is the 18-inch REI Coupe Flash, $18, $50 at REI.com. Reflective wear. The National Safety Council advises that walkers wear brighter reflective clothing for visibility. You can choose hats and other accessories, T-shirts and jackets, including this can't-miss-seeing-it lightweight L.L. Bean Bright Multi-Sport Jacket for $99. And supportive shoes. Stability is the key in walking shoes, says Timothy J. Miller, DPM, a podiatrist in Orlando, Florida. So is comfort. He suggests footwear with stiff soles and a back that's rigid, not soft. This should reduce any foot pain and stress and strain on the joints and ligaments, Miller says. Also good. A deep tread of the soles for traction to help prevent falls. Shoes that may work include the Axis Gel Keanu above, which is the picture above, which is $160. The Brooks Aerial, $160 from Brooks Running Company. And the Hoka Arai, $145 from Hoka.com, according to Miller. Rollators. Want to be able to take a break while you're out and about? Consider a rollator. A kind of rolling walker that usually has a seat, along with two fixed wheels in the back and two that swivel in the front. If you're standing for longer than you like, you can park the rollator against a wall or fence, lock the wheels, and sit. These can be a boon if you tend to get out of breath while walking, and for those who have pain in their knees or hips, says Cameron Hernandez, MD, a professor of internal medicine, geriatrics, and palliative medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York. Choosing right. You want a padded seat with back support and a basket. Look for front wheels that swivel well without wiggling, Hernandez says, to help you negotiate sidewalk cracks and bumps in door sills. Make sure it's easy to use the handbrake's locking mechanism, which you'll need when you sit. Options include Nova Medical Products Express Rollator Walker and the Medicine Premium Explorer Folding Mobility Rotator Walker. Both of those are range, well, the Nova is $260, the Rollator Walker is $151. Both fold up tightly for easier transport and space-saving storage. The Nova also has all-terrain wheels. Big, fat wheels, kind of cool. Cycling. Riding a bike for doing errands or visiting friends or just fun is easier on your hips and knees than walking, and it can strengthen your heart and lungs. Whether you use an electric bike or a conventional one, but depend on where you ride, what you want to spend, and your comfort level. With an electric motor that can assist you while you're pedaling, or models with a throttle, replace pedaling altogether, an e-bike can be a good option if you tire while riding. They tend to be pricier and heavier than the conventional bicycle. Choosing right. Jeffrey E. Carrick, Ph.D., director at the University of Lynchburg Active Aging Program, recommends a Class 1 or Class 2 e-bike for older adults. You might want to get your doctor's okay, too. Motors on Class 1 e-bikes turn on only when you pedal and cut out when your speed goes over 20 miles per hour. Class 2 e-bikes also feature electric assist up to 20 miles per hour. Their motors can be activated by pedaling or with a throttle control on the handlebar. For either class, consider a step-to frame, which has a low tube top or none at all, so you don't have to lift your leg high to get on and off. Upright handlebars, a plush seat, and wide tires also add comfort. Take some practice spins in a traffic area before road riding. When you add a motor, you're moving a little quicker and things happen a little faster and your actions need to adjust, Henrik says. Conventional bicycles. Several types of conventional bicycles are good picks for local trips. Comfort bikes such as cruisers have wide tires, cushy seats, and upright handlebars for a comfortable and steady ride. Upright adult tricycles tend to offer good stability and cargo space. One tricycle option, the EverJourney Tricycle, $600 at 630.com. Cruisers and tricycles are primarily for permanent and short distances. For pavement and short distances, hybrids, a mix of road bike and mountain bike, have lower handlebars and narrow tires, but can handle gravel and dirt paths and go farther and faster. The smaller wheels on folding bikes, like the CR-rated Zismo Euro Mini Urbano, $430, with an overall score of 80, let you get on and off more easily. Choosing right. Look for a step-through design like that on the Schwinn Destiny step-through cruiser below and the Trek Townie TD74 step-through. CR experts also recommended disc brakes, a gel or memory foam seat that can make sitting more comfortable, and if you're riding on hills, opt for a bike with multiple speeds. Thinking about a folding bike? Be sure it's easy to fold, unfold, and carry. And here's a list of different cycling gear. You want a powered ride? The Cannondale Adventure Neo 4 for $2,800. The 9-speed 50-pound Adventure Neo 4 has easy to pedal without power and has excellent battery range and hydraulic disc brakes and a very good acceleration in mid-motor drive motor mounted to the pedals but more responsive than a hub drive motor mounted in the rear hub. Avaton Place for a Class 2 bike. Well, the previous one was a Class 1. This is a Class 2. This 8-speed, 53-pound model cruises and goes uphill well without any power. Its hub-mounted electric motor takes off fast and climbs even steep hills quickly. It also has excellent brakes and very good battery range, and it sells for $1,600. The folding, the Blick Fika Flex, well, that's an interesting name, for just under $1,900, is a Class 2 e-bike that easy ride on flats and hills without power. With the motor on, it accelerates quickly. It also has excellent braking and good battery range. At 54 pounds, it's heavier than some other folding e-bikes in our test, but they all scored high. Got a good helmet? A bike helmet can significantly cut head your risk of a head or brain injury in an accident. Look for protective technology such as a multi-directional impact protection system, a MIPS, or wave cell, which is designed to reduce the likelihood of a concussion. Try on a helmet if you're considering to check the fit, which should be snug with the straps forming a V underneath and slightly forward of each earlobe. Check out some of our top-rated models. The Trek Starvos wave cell for $105, the Laser Tempo Kennet Care for $50, the Bellforming LED MIS Ghost for $140, and the Giro Register MIPS from $35.98. Be seen, be seen. Ride safe, reflective stickers. Fluorescent clothes, a bright yellow on white, can help drivers see you. Also good, reflective stickers on your bike or helmet, like these from Ride Sex and Lexus Sticker at RideSafe.com, and a lights, a bell, or a horn, and a rear view mirror. And reflective stickers are $14. And carry your stuff with ease. State Bicycle Company Saddlebag. A compact saddlebag can hold, compact saddle or handlebar bag can hold your wallet, phone, and other essentials. One option is the State Bicycle Company saddlebag, which attaches beneath and behind the bike seat, and it sells for $30. How to track your health at home. Blood pressure monitor, fitness tracker, cholesterol test. Hear what you need and what you can skip. Nearly one-third of Americans do not have a primary care provider, a number that has been on the rise for years. If you do have a regular doctor, it may be difficult to get in to see them when you want. According to a survey of 15 metropolitan areas in the U.S., wait times for a doctor's appointment are significantly longer now than they have been at any point when the survey began 20 years ago. This can make it more challenging for you to be clear on the state of your health and to get any potential issues addressed before they escalate. On the upside, there are a growing number of ways to monitor your health yourself between doctor's appointments, says Jeffrey Colgren, MD, an associate professor in the Department of Internal Medicine at the University of Michigan Medical School in Ann Arbor. While you may already have a first aid kit, considering adding a few items to it, normally those that would allow you to track your blood pressure, temperature, heart rate, weight, and more without leaving home. You won't be alone in this, and random testing is on the rise, according to a 2022 poll conducted at the University of Michigan. But while monitoring tools can be quite useful, it can be hard to know what's worth spending money on, Colgren says. Home blood pressure monitors, for example, have been shown to help people with hypertension keep their condition under control. Yet these devices may someday be marketed to people who don't really need them, and not all the home blood pressure monitors on the market are accurate. Perhaps most important, even diligent home monitoring can't replace a trusted clinician. These tools have the higher value when they get to use together with guidance from your healthcare provider, Colgren says. Let's take a look at some of the most useful at-home devices for assessing different aspects of your health and other home health products you may want to leave on the store shelves. And we have a picture here of a blood pressure monitor, Omon Platinum for $84 from Amazon, a digital scale, which is smart, Electric Apex from $80, and a fitness tracker, Fitbit for $100, and digital thermometer, Bermoscan for $42. Four helpful devices. Expert advice on choosing and using these self-assessment tools and some of the top picks from CR's rigorous tests. Blood pressure monitor. This allows people to track their blood pressure at home. That's useful because almost half of U.S. adults, nearly 120 million people, have high blood pressure, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and only about a quarter of them have the condition under control. Hypertension means your systolic, top number is 130 milligrams Hg or higher, and your diastolic, bottom number is 80 milligrams or higher. Anything over 120 milligrams systolic is considered hypertension. What it's useful for? A home blood pressure monitor is a must for anyone with high blood pressure. It is worth considering for people with pre-hypertension, too, says cardiologist Nitschke Globerg, MD, a clinical associate professor of medicine at the NYU Grossman School of Medicine in New York City. It can help you get more accurate and consistent blood pressure readings in a doctor's office and lets you see how your blood pressure changes in response to lifestyle changes or medications. For best results, take your blood pressure twice daily. At the same time of day, Goldberg says, each time take two or three readings, a minute or two apart. Use an arm cuff monitor if possible. Our tests have found that they're more reliable than wrist cuff models. Don't smoke, exercise, or consume caffeine or alcohol for 30 minutes beforehand. Use the bathroom and rest quietly for at least 5 minutes. Then sit with your back straight and supported on a hard chair, feet flat on the floor. Your arms should be supported on a flat surface, such as a table, with your upper arm at heart level. Record all of your results and bring them to your doctor, Goldberg says, to better inform your treatment. A thermometer, an old standby for kids. This device is critical for adults, too, whether you don't feel well. It's helpful to know if a fever has set in and how high it is, says Michael Hockman, MD, MPH, a Los Angeles internist. If a fever lasts for more than 3 days or rises above 104 degrees Fahrenheit, see your doctor. Just an aside, we're not supposed to editorialize, but aside. When I was in Vietnam as a helicopter pilot, we had different ratings for medevacs, and one of the things, if you had a fever of over 104, it was an emergency medevac, which means it was first priority. Who it's useful for? Everyone. It's a good idea to take your temperature a couple times when you're not sick to determine your personal baseline. A study published last year in the Journal of American Medicine found that normal temperatures range anywhere from 97.2 to 98.4, with an overall average of 97.9. Note, temperatures tend to be lowest early in the morning and highest around 4 in the afternoon. Best results. If you have a fever, Hockman recommends that you take your temperature twice daily to get a clear picture, once in the morning and once in the evening. A 2021 study published by the journal Biology tested 7 thermometer types and found that the in-ear thermometer, which uses an infrared sensor to measure the temperature inside your ear canal, was the most accurate. Sierra's testings for accuracy, consistency, and more. Fitness tracker. A fitness tracker uses a sensor to gather data about your physical activity and use these things wirelessly with a smartphone app. These range from a simple clip-on devices to expensive watches with high-definition screens. What's it useful for? Anyone who wants to know more about how much exercise they're actually getting or who is doing twice their activity level, aim for at least 150 minutes of moderate intensity or 75 minutes of high-intensity activity per week. along with two muscle strengthening workouts. Many also have the ability to track changes in your heart rate, which is a good way to see if you are improving on your fitness level, says Cedric Bryant, Ph.D., President and Chief Science Officer of the American Council on Exercise. For best results, to stay in the know of your activity levels, you need to have a fitness tracker with you anytime you're on the move. If you don't want an extra device, check your smartphone or smartwatch to see if it has the functions you're seeking. They may be found in an Apple Health, Google Fit, or Samsung Health app. For many people, the fitness tracker or smartphone that only counts steps or minutes of activity may be sufficient. And with either, you can typically set and easily change your goals for steps, length of activity, distance, or stairs climbed in per day. For heart rate data, what trackers provide is often an estimate, so they're best used as a way to monitoring changes in your fitness level. Bryant says, CR's fitness tracker ratings include an assessment of the heart rating monitoring accuracy. Bathroom scale. Some scales simply tell you how much you weigh, which is generally enough information for most people. But so-called smart scales may also calculate the percentage of your weight that comes from fat or your body mass index, or BMI, a weight measure that has drawn criticism recently. Among other issues, BMI doesn't distinguish among muscle fat and bone mass, so it might not provide much insight. And here are four items that I mentioned. Blood pressure monitor from Omron Silver. That's $47 from Amazon. The digital scale, which is kind of cool because it's clear. WWW26 for $20. A fitness tracker from Garmin Venu Triv for $270, a wristwatch. And the digital thermometer from Solido at $25, which is not a bad price, really. Excuse me, here's a continuation of the scale thing, which I didn't realize was on the next page. People who are trying to lose or maintain weight may use the primary use of the bathroom scale. But these increasingly slick tools are also essential for anyone with heart failure, because even small change in weight can be an important warning sign of a related problem, such as fluid retention. For weight loss, some research finds that people who get on the scale daily are more successful than those who do so only once or a few times a week. It's one of the most useful tools in weight management there is, says Colgren at the University of Michigan Medical School. Other research suggests that weighing yourself regularly may lead to unhealthy eating habits. For best results, weighing yourself first thing in the morning tends to be the most accurate because you haven't had anything to eat or drink overnight, Culligan says. Some fluctuation is normal. If you have heart failure and gain more than 2 or 3 pounds in a 24-hour period or more than 5 pounds in a week, it may be because of fluid retention. Unexpected weight loss in people with heart failure could be a sign the condition has progressed. In either case, notify your doctor. Also worth considering, want more health tracking options in your toolbox? Here are a few others you might find helpful. Online hearing test. This can be useful for anyone who wants to get a general sense of their hearing ability, says Catherine Palmer, Ph.D., Director of Audiology at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. You can take one such test at an app from the World Health Organization. Search for Hear WHO in your app store. Get more on this at cr.org/hearing test. Dynamometer. This handheld tool lets you get a grip strength test, a good gauge of overall muscle strength, for adults over 65. A healthy minimum squeeze in older adults is about 73 pounds for men and 44 for women. If yours is below that, ask your doctor about strength training or physical therapy. Blood glucose monitor. Use that a lot. Using a drop of blood in this device can check your blood sugar level. Glucose monitors are essential for people who use insulin and very helpful for tracking how those with diabetes and prediabetes respond to certain foods. They've also been marketed to people without diabetes, but no research shows that they're beneficial for this group, says Stephen Furr, M.D., president of the American Academy of Family Physicians. And a cardio machine. Anyone who wants to track their fitness levels during their workout may find a treadmill or an exercise bike useful. These can typically determine your heart rate during a workout, an important metric of your overall physical health. Ideally, use a machine with a chest strap heart rate monitor, rather than hand grip sensors, which tend to be less accurate. Over time, as you become more fit, your heart rate should begin to gradually decrease, says Cedric Bryan, Ph.D., the American Council on Exercise. Pay attention to how easily you can breathe while exercising. Any increase in your shortness of breath without an increase in your usual intensity and warrants a call to the doctor. Any chest pain should signal it's time for a heart workup. How often should you see a doctor? An adequate physical is often touted as crucial, but do you need one? A 2021 review published in the Journal of American Medicine found that while general health checks weren't associated with lower rates of death, heart attack, stroke, or cardiovascular disease, there were some clear benefits. Annual checkups were associated with increased detection of issues such as depression and high blood pressure, greater use of important screening tests for conditions such as colon or cervical cancer, and a better quality of life. Regular check-ins, even if not quite annual, are a way for you and your doctor to catch up on your health history in a more relaxed setting, says Michael Hockman, MD, MPH, a Los Angeles internist. It's also a good time to make sure you're up to date on health screenings and vaccinations. You can ward off a slew of problems, including costly, time-consuming medical visits further down the road, Hockman says. If you're under age 50 with no underlying medical conditions, guidelines don't say you have to see a doctor annually. But if you're 50 or older, it may be unwise to skip that yearly exam. And if you take any meds or have a chronic issue such as high blood pressure, elevated cholesterol, or type 2 diabetes, you really need an annual checkup, says Stephen Furr, MD, president of the American Academy of Family Physicians. Most likely you need to be seen two or three times a year. And there's a few more things in this article we'll get with next week, but for now we're going to close up in just a second. But before we do that, let's have a couple of giggles. Many sailors agree that the best part of owning a boat is naming it. If you're looking for a monitor, here are some suggestions from the National Boaters Association. Away from it all, c'est la vie, seize the day, fish sizzle, Lady Kriller, Marlon Monroe, Tuna Colada, Bates Motel. My biology report titled Your Intestines, How Digestion Works was marked down to great. Turns out I'd forgotten the colon. For Mother's Day, let's celebrate the comical side of motherhood with classic mom gags. You know you're a mom when you understand in a deep level why Mama Bear's porridge was too cold. If I ever go missing, just follow my kids. They could find me whenever I try to hide. Good moms let you lick the beaters after making brownies. Great moms turn them off first. My mom's superpower is being the only person in the house who can see an empty toilet paper roll. Three prosperous sons decide to give their elderly mother their best Mother's Day ever. First said, I built Mama a mansion. The second son said, I bought her a new Mercedes. I got you both, Bert, said the son. Since Mom has trouble reading the Bible because of her eyesight, I seen her a parrot that can recite the entire Bible. It took 20 monks 12 years to teach him. Thereafter, Mom emailed each son. Bruce, she wrote, the first son, the house built is so huge I live only in one room but have to clean the whole house. Barry, she wrote the second son, I'm too old to travel, so I never use a Mercedes. And dearest Mark, she wrote to the third son, you have the sense to know what I like, what your mother likes. That chicken was delicious. That last one's so old it creaks. We have run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So